I'm Mike Papantonio, and you're listening to the best of Ring of Fire. Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Mike Papantonio. Today on Ring of Fire, we'll be revisiting some of the very best interviews from more than a decade of being on the air. We'll hear from Howard Zinn. We'll hear from Chalmers Johnson, Daniel Ellsberg, and several other huge newsmakers and some of the most brilliant progressive minds of our time. Let's get things started with a conversation we had with Tom Hartman on his film, The Last Hours of Humanity, where he warned us about the looming dangers of global climate change.
I'm joined now by radio and TV host Tom Hartman, who recently put together a short documentary on the threats being posed by climate change. So, Tom, tell us about the video series. Last Hours is the first of a series of short films. Tell us about what the entire series hopes to achieve.
Well, we hope to change the conversation around climate change and, you know, get people engaged and enthusiastic and active, frankly. The first in the series talks about a really important issue, and that is the possible extinction of most of all life on Earth, which would, of course, include humans. This has happened five times in the Earth's deep geologic history, and every time it was driven by climate change. And but, you know, I can get into more depth on that. In fact, we will in a minute. But, you know, how this time is different from and similar to those times. But this is a conversation that the geologists have been having. And this is what got me all excited about making these videos, is I've been a member of AAAS, you know, the big science organization, for years and years. And I get science. And I've been reading these geologic journals, or these studies published in Science that are cross-published in geology journals, that are talking about parallels between the current era and things like the Permian mass extinction. And none of it has been making its way into the popular media. It's not been making its way pretty much beyond geology. And even climatologists are largely unaware of the mechanism by which the five great extinctions on planet Earth happened. So our first video was to explain that.
Well, tell us what is the Permian mass extinction, and tell us what those five great extinctions, what were they and what caused them?
Right. Well, a mass extinction is defined as a time when more than half of all life on Earth vanishes, and within a relatively short geologic period of time, which is typically, you know, 80 to 100,000 years. And there have been five times in the history of the Earth, in the 5 billion year history of the Earth, and the roughly 1 billion year history of life on Earth, there have been five times where more than half of all life got wiped out. The one that's the most famous is what's called the KT extinction, the one where the dinosaurs vanished. That was 65 million years ago. But that was only, you know, we only lost about 65-70% of species with that extinction. A lot of stuff survived that became ultimately us. But the Permian mass extinction was the worst of the five. This was 250 million years ago. And in the Permian mass extinction, depending on whose numbers you're using and looking at, somewhere between 95 and 97% of all life on Earth vanished, both in the oceans and on land. It was the mother of all extinctions.
And what drove those extinctions?
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, Sam. What we find is that in each case, the extinctions were caused by the crust of the Earth being either penetrated or cracking open, and in the process releasing enough greenhouse gases to produce radical greenhouse gas-driven global warming, which rendered the planet inhospitable for the currently existing species. So most of them died off, and the few that could adapt to the new temperature normals became the next reboot. You know, the dinosaurs died off and the mammals came along, because mammals were warm-blooded and they could deal with the new temperatures post-KT. So when they up until the 1960s, really nobody knew what any of these extinctions, what caused any of them. There was this theory that they had all been caused by meteorites hitting the Earth and puncturing the Earth's crust, and then that would, you know, let enough of these gases escape from the Earth that it would produce this global warming that would kill things off. They nailed down the meteorite theory for the KT extinction, the 165 million years ago. It was apparently a meteorite that hit the Earth around near where Cancun is, where that basically made the Gulf of Mexico. And that punched a big enough hole in the Earth that enough carbon-containing and other greenhouse gases were released. But it wasn't really until around 2000, 2002 that they nailed down what caused the Permian, the worst of all of them. And they had always assumed it was a meteorite. It turns out it wasn't. It happened during a time when the Earth had only one continent on it. And as that continent started moving and splitting into two and all these other processes, but this actually preceded that. It presaged that. There was this huge volcanic eruption that went on for thousands of years called in an area that we now call Siberia. The region is called the Siberian Traps. And over a period of time, this volcanic eruption produced enough greenhouse gases that it raised the temperature of the Earth ultimately, you know, when the whole thing was all done, by probably somewhere between 20 and 30 degrees Celsius, which just, you know, wiped out everything.
Now, when we talk about the inability of species to adapt, is it simply a function of a change in temperature, or is it a function of what the change in temperature does to the access to things like food and et cetera?
It's very much the latter. Biosystems, ecosystems change, and plants, animals, and sometimes the microorganisms that support them. For example, trees exist because there's fungi on their roots and bacteria on their roots that transport nutrients into them. And in some cases, climate change, it makes those bacteria and fungi not work as well. And so the trees can't transport the nutrients that they need. And you end up with fragile trees that are vulnerable to things like rust and, you know, beetles and funguses and things. So that's the process. The two really important points that we try to make in this first movie are, number one, there are tipping points. And when you hit those tipping points into a mass extinction, you typically don't know that you've passed the tipping point until you're already past it. And number two, that the major tipping point is the release of methane gas that is frozen in ice slurries around the coasts of the continents and in the Arctic region and in the Arctic permafrost. And number three, really, if you think of the first five extinctions, four of them were caused by massive volcanic activity. One was caused by a meteorite punching a hole that was functionally the same thing as massive volcanic activity. In each case, the core, the crust of the Earth was breached. What we have been doing for 150 years now is the same thing. We have been breaching the crust of the Earth. We've been drilling holes into the Earth. Only instead of doing it like with a big thick hammer that just goes whap, you know, with the meteorite, for example, hitting Cancun or the Siberian Traps going off for 1,000 years, instead of doing that in that blunt force way where, you know, you're hitting some areas that are carbon rich and some areas that are carbon poor and you get all kinds of other stuff going on, you know, volcanic rock and stuff. Instead of doing that, what we've been doing is searching the planet for the carbon rich areas and then drilling specifically into them or mining specifically into them, extracting the carbon-containing compounds, natural gas, coal, and oil, and then burning those and throwing the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So we have altered the planet's atmosphere by punching holes in the crust and pulling out these ancient stores of carbon the same way functionally. I mean, the mechanism has been different, but the end result could be the same as in these previous five mass extinctions. And there's, we have burned 350 billion tons of carbon. We have burned it and thrown it into the atmosphere since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, roughly 1850. 350 billion tons. And that has produced a 1 degree temperature increase, which means that there's another degree that's pretty much unstoppable. There's always, whatever you've done, there's that much in the pipeline before it exhausts itself. So that 350 billion tons is producing a 2 degree Celsius temperature increase, or ultimately will. Just in the Arctic, there's somewhere between 1 and 2 trillion tons of carbon in the form of methane, largely, in the Arctic permafrost and in these methane hydrate, these methane snow cone slushes just under the ice in, on the surface of the shallow, relatively shallow surface of the Arctic Ocean. And
that's basically functioning like a loaded gun.
Right.
And we got to take a break. But when we come back, let's talk about the rate of methane gas release and greenhouse gases in the last 5 great extinctions and where we are relative to that in this it's a little clinical to call it a process, but that's what we're involved in. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with Tom Hartman when we return. Back on Ring of Fire, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Tom Hartman about his new short documentary, The Last Hours of Humanity, which talks about the disastrous consequences of global climate change that humanity is currently facing and causing. So, Tom, when we broke, we were talking about the enormous potential that sits underneath the ice caps and the ice slurries, particularly in the poles of our planet, and how the release of those gases are going to impact us. Before we talk about that impact, let's just go back, because you had mentioned that the series of films that are going to be released, the specific one that is released first, shows that we've had 5 great extinctions in the past. Where are we? And you describe those great extinctions as taking place over the course of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. Where are we in the process of hitting those tipping points that you mentioned?
Well, this is the big problem, Sam. Nobody knows. And that's why we made this movie Last Hours and put it up at lasthours.org. What we do know is that there's more carbon dioxide in the air than in the entire history of the human race. What we do know is that there's between 1 and 2 trillion tons of carbon frozen in the form of frozen methane in the Arctic. And the Arctic is warming 2 to 3 times faster than the equatorial and temperate regions. What we do know is that there's somewhere between 4 and 12 trillion tons of carbon along the continental shelves of the Earth. And that 90%, the latest IPCC report, 90% of global warming is being absorbed by our oceans. Now, because that methane itself freezes at like 300 degrees below zero, this is not frozen methane. What it is it's frozen ice. The methane forms when plant matter decays and falls to the bottom of the ocean. It starts to rot, and as it rots, it releases methane gas, natural gas. But if it's at a point where the water is colder than 32 degrees, but is still kept liquid because it's under great pressure, because it's deep enough in the ocean, then that methane will cause the water around it to form an ice crystal that wouldn't normally form. And in the center of that ice crystal is a bubble of methane. And you get enough of this and you get, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of tons of this stuff. It's like giant pools of this stuff along the surface, all along the coasts of all the continents. And because it's frozen water, not frozen methane, you know, water changes from a solid state to a liquid state with about a 1 degree temperature differential. You know, you go from 31 to 32 degrees and you go from ice to water, or 32 to 33. and depending on the pressure. And in this case, it might be 30 to 31, or it might be 29 to 30, you know, depending on how deep the methane clathrates, hydrates are. But it's just a 1 degree. It might be a 2 degree. It depends on how deep it is, but it's not much. It doesn't take much. The Permian, and the BBC did a brilliant documentary on this. You can watch the whole thing. It's an hour long. They did it back in 2003. It's called The Day the Earth Nearly Died, and you can find it on YouTube really easily if you just plug that, The Day the Earth Nearly Died, in. And what they found was, you know, okay, here's this 80,000-year period of the Permian mass extinction, but there was this sudden pulse about 40,000 years into it where, you know, after these Siberian traps have been erupting, where suddenly there was so much carbon in the rock layer, and it coincided with a time when all the fossils vanished. It was like the Earth died, and there was all this carbon-12. And there was more carbon that could be accounted for by the death of all the plants and animals on Earth and in the sea. So where did it come from? And this was first published in 1998, you know, asking where the heck did this carbon come from? And it wasn't until around 2000 that a guy named Jerry Dickens published a paper saying, well, it looks like the methane frozen under the seas get melted and bubbled up through the water and into the air. And methane is 70 times roughly more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And when it does decay, it decays to carbon dioxide. And so that methane, that pulse of methane, produced an enormous and sudden surge of global warming. So, you know, while the Permian took thousands of years, all of the mass, the KT was faster because it was initiated by an asteroid, but the Permian and the other three all apparently took thousands of years. Climatologist Michael Mann says on our video, and any geologist will tell you this, the rate at which we're pumping carbon into the atmosphere right now, we humans, is faster than has happened in any of the previous mass extinctions, with the possible exception of the KT with the meteorite, but it's faster than the other four. So we don't know when we're going to hit that tipping point, but what we do know is if we pass that tipping point, we probably won't know it for a generation or two, but within 100 or 200 years, we will no longer be here. So I encourage people to get over to lasthours.org and check it out.
Thanks so much, Tom. We appreciate your time today.
Thanks for highlighting this, Sam. I really appreciate it.
Tom Hartman is the host of the Tom Hartman Program in The Big Picture. You can watch his new film, The Last Hours of Humanity, online at lasthours.org.
Coming up on Ring of Fire, Daniel Ellsberg will be joining us to talk about America's surveillance state. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and you're listening to Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. President Obama recently gave a speech where he addressed the issue of domestic surveillance and the revelations that came forward last summer from whistleblower Edward Snowden. The president dodged the issue of whether or not these activities would continue indefinitely, and Americans are left to wonder just how deep the surveillance on American citizens go and how much a threat this is to our beloved constitutional guarantees in the Bill of Rights. Joining me now to talk about this is Daniel Ellsberg, a former U.S. military analyst. Let me ask you about what's happening today. In your opinion, is Edward Snowden, I mean, you are a hero to our generation. You changed, you know, you ended the Vietnam War. Without you, it would not have ended when it did. You exposed, you know, all of this history of government lies. You changed the way people felt about their government. We grew up in a world where we couldn't believe that the United States government would lie to us. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, you show that this terrible web of history of lies that and just the background for people who don't know about this, McNamara commissioned a report. McNamara, who was always anti-war, although he escalated it, McNamara commissioned the Pentagon and I think the Rand Corporation to do a history of the war, of how we had gotten into it, to make sure it could never happen again. And you were part of the team. You had worked for Henry Kissinger. You were this brilliant Harvard kid who had been to Vietnam, who had been in the Marines, was a war hero, and came back and from Vietnam and was a war hawk at one point. And now you were looking at it and saying, this is not what it was supposed to be. But you were part of that group that went through tens of thousands of documents and traced how we had gotten into it. One of those copies was an Iran Corporation safe. You got pissed off one night because the Nixon administration had dropped a lawsuit against a group of special forces and CIA team who had murdered a South Vietnamese informant and dumped his body in the South China Sea. And you said, that's it for me. I'm going to give this to the New York Times. And you Xerox this doc, the, I don't know, 28 volumes or whatever it was, and gave it to the New York Times. And that was the end. And so you really changed history, and you're a hero. Do you consider Edward Snowden, or let's even broaden it, Julian Assange, to be doing the same thing you were doing, or is there a difference?
There are very great similarities, and of course there are differences. The differences don't change my opinion at all that Edward Snowden and before him Chelsea Manning, and in a different role, Julian Assange, he was a publisher, sort of in the role of the New York Times relative to the Pentagon Papers. He was not the source, but he was the medium for this, still at considerable risk to himself. They are personal heroes of mine. I think they're Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden are great Americans. Julian Assange is not American, which means he's not eligible to be a traitor, but he was eligible to be called a traitor by everyone, just as, interestingly, Snowden is being called a traitor by the Australian Prime Minister. Actually, that's Assange's home base, Australia. And for some reason, the Foreign Minister are pronouncing on Edward Snowden as a traitor, which is ridiculous. He's no more a traitor than I am, and I'm not. Definitely. And in the account you gave of this, which is right in general outlines, but incorrect in certain things. For example, I worked for Henry Kissinger after the Pentagon Papers, after I'd worked on the Pentagon Papers in the Nixon administration. And I was certainly not a war hero. I was a civilian in Vietnam, and I did use my Marine training from some years earlier as a rifle platoon leader and a rifle company commander. I used that experience to walk with troops without endangering them in combat and did see a fair amount of combat. So I saw the war close up in Vietnam, and it had a big influence on me. And I did work on the Pentagon Papers. Another little correction here. The Pentagon Papers, you said, were in a safe at Rand. They were in my safe. Very few people had top secret safes in their office. At Rand, they had to go to the top secret control office for that. They had only secret files. I was one of the few with a top secret safe, and that was in part because I had been authorized to study the Pentagon Papers. I was one of, actually the only researcher, along with the president of the company, who had access to the papers at that time. Now, that's a very close analogy to Snowden, because what he gave was material that he had access to, and in effect authorized access, because, as he said, for contractors at Booz Allen working for the NSA, once you were in and you had the clearances, which he had, and the authorized access to the systems, there were no rules. There was very little oversight from then on. At that point, he was free. He said anyone in his position could have simply walked out that door for any reason. With all that information, and could have sold it for a very great price to various foreign powers, which again, any more than Chelsea Manning, he did not do. He gave it to the American people without any recompense and at risk of his life from then on. And I'll tell you really why, as I just heard him say in an interview with German television, I was watching it last night, which I recommend to people, by the way. Just look up Snowden and German television on Google News, and you'll find it. And he said, I will never be fully out of danger. He says, unless these systems totally change, which is frankly very far off. And I think that's true for the same reason that President Nixon actually brought a dozen Cuban CIA assets from the Bay of Pigs to incapacitate me on the steps of the Capitol on May 3rd, 1972, a year into my trial and a year away from the ending of my trial. So in the midst of that, he brought people up to incapacitate me, and that had really nothing to do with what I had already revealed. And the reason
that was Howard Hunt. That was Howard.
What he hasn't revealed, they're afraid of him, and Nixon was afraid of me because of what they knew I knew that had not yet been revealed, and they needed to shut that up. It wasn't enough to put me on trial. It will never be enough for them to put Snowden on trial and let him out on bail. If he came back to this country, I do not believe at all that he would be given a moment's freedom. He would be incarcerated in isolation like Chelsea Manning from the moment he arrived, the moment he was captured, or they kidnapped him, and he'd never get out and could very well simply be killed, either kept in isolation or killed, because, first of all, there's a lot that hasn't come out yet that he has given to the newspapers, but beyond that, he's made it clear that he chose what he gave to the newspapers and what he thought the public needed to know. Which should be public, and he has held back and did not give to the newspapers or copy or bring with him a tremendous amount of material that he felt would not serve a public interest to be put out and was deservedly secret. But they would never trust him on that, not to decide to put some of that on under some circumstances, or put out stuff that should be out, but they didn't want out, and that hasn't yet come out. He'll never be safe from that. Russia is probably as safe a place as he can find, because it's one of the few countries, with all its shortcomings still, that is willing to stand up to the U.S. on this and not simply hand him over. And other countries that could agree with him politically were not willing to give him asylum. He applied to practically every country in Europe.
Dan, can you stay with us and talk a little more after the break?
Sure.
We'll be right back with more from Daniel Ellsberg. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and you're listening to Ring of Fire. Back on Ring of Fire, I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Right now, I'm talking with former military analyst turned activist Dan Ellsberg about the United States domestic spying programs. Let me ask you two more questions, because you've been very generous with your time. One is this kind of cognitive dissonance that allows us to do the drone strikes and the invasions of Iraq, etc. And it's something that my father was deeply concerned about. He talked about the toll on civilians in Vietnam, which we now know was somewhere around 7 million people died in that war, and over the 20 years that we were there and with the French.
30 years.
But today, you know, I give this analogy. If there's now 37 nations that have drones, right, including Canada, if there were some Quebec independent group had committed a crime in Canada and then fled to the United States to Brooklyn, for example, and the Canadian military and security police knew that they were in an apartment in Brooklyn and sent a drone strike down and killed that apartment and killed, you know, a couple of other people in the building. You know, how would we feel about that? And what if we feel that that's wrong, then how can we be doing that to people in Pakistan and Yemen and Afghanistan and the Sudan and all these other countries, because we consider ourselves a humane nation. And how do we allow ourselves to, you know, how do we rationalize murdering civilians with nations we aren't even at war with, but murdering civilians?
You said that as eloquently and as passionately as your father would have if he were alive, and I can just hear him denouncing this right now. Of course, the questions really answer themselves once you've raised them in that way. The incident you hypothesize there, they're sending drones over to kill people over here, the country would be, I think, at first absolutely stunned as well as shocked with outrage and horror at the very idea of...
And then a week later, Canada would be the 51st state, right? I mean, we would invade them. We would consider an act of war.
Right. And the, so why don't they do that? Because we are so strong. So we're safe in doing this, right? Well, actually, making ourselves the most hated nation in the world in Pakistan, a country, an unstable country with nuclear weapons, and a fanatical Islamic fundamentalist who law in the international, the ISI, the intelligence apparatus there, that wants to get control of those nuclear weapons and share them or use them. I can't imagine any policy more dangerous than what President Obama, far more than Bush, has actually pursued in killing all kinds of people, both killing people we consider terrorists and people who by any standards are children, babies, old women, civilians, along with them. And by the way, not just a couple when we kill a terrorist. I think the ratio of civilians get killed is something like 17-1 compared to people we claim to be terrorists without knowing that. They are experiencing that in that country. Are they just somehow peculiar for hating the country that does this to them? You're raising the question, how would we feel? Well, that isn't too hard to answer. And I'm saying that's dangerous. It's dangerous to be earning hatred like that. And not only in Pakistan, but in many other countries in the world. I am very happy. I have very great criticisms of President Obama, as you've heard, although I supported him for election in both the last elections because I thought that the Republican opponent would be even worse. And I still think that, and the confirmation of that is we're not bombing Syria today, and we're not following the siren call to involve ourselves in that very tragic and horrible situation in Syria, and we're not bombing Iran. And I believe that the Republican opponents would be bombing Iran. They wouldn't necessarily be worse on many of the things we've been discussing, the civil liberties aspect and the surveillance. They might be about the same. I think when it comes to being at war in Syria and Iran, we would be. So I, where credit is due, I credit Obama with responding to public pressure on that. But what is he responding to? During a congressional recess, constituents amazed their representatives, according to all the news stories, by buttonholing them in malls and restaurants and wherever they found them and saying, no war in Syria. We don't want war with Syria. Now, when I read that, I thought, like the Congress people, where did that come from? What's this? They didn't object to Libya or what got into them. I don't know fully the answer to that. I think Snowden played a role, by the way, in this kind of, we've had enough. This is it. You know, no more of this. Or as Gorbachev said to his wife, Raisa, when he was deciding whether to take the job of General Secretary, we can't go on like this. And I'm waiting for some leaders to say that. We can't go on like this.
I have one last question for you, which is the corrosive impact of excessive corporate power on American democracy and American values. And you know, you saw as far back as the Vietnam War that in many ways our military and intelligence apparatus became kind of a servant of the mercantile interests of U.S. corporations. Has that trend amplified over time, and how much of a problem do you think it is to our democracy?
Well, you know, at the time when I was in the government, and I was, you say military, but I was an official, special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense, and then a Forward Service Officer Reserve One, highest ranking, in the embassy in Saigon. And I have to say that I was, and earlier at the RAND Corporation as a consultant, I wasn't really conscious at that time of corporate influence of the kind that Eisenhower had referred to, the military-industrial complex. I didn't see that. Even when I thought our policy was mistaken, as in Vietnam, I didn't see it as a result of corporate influence. And to this day, that's a complex question on Vietnam. What were the influences on that? But on Iraq, that's not so hard to see. The oil industry there was crucial. To this day, we have not learned the makeup, the membership of Vice President Cheney's task force on energy, which was looking at the invasion of Iraq and parceling out the oil fields there to various corporations. He refused to make public who he had consulted with. And I would presume that Obama could tell us that, could find that out and put it out, but he's honoring that secret somehow. So we have a corporate influence there that is relatively open. And that's true in Iran, too, really, among other things. There are various influences, but the oil of Iran has always been a target. But on the surveillance matter, it's really Snowden, I think, who's done a lot to alert us to what amounts to a corporate government collaboration. Makes them almost the same unit, which Mussolini called corporatism or fascism, where there's really very little distinction between certain corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton, for which Snowden worked as a contractor, and the NSA or the telephone companies.
Daniel Ellsberg is a former U.S. military analyst, best known for releasing the Pentagon Papers, which detailed the decision-making process that led America into the Vietnam War. Thank you for joining us today, Dan.
Thank you for having me. Great opportunity.
Just ahead on Ring of Fire, we'll hear an interview from the great Chalmers Johnson, where he'll tell us why America's obsession with empire building is going to be a disaster for this country. I'm Mike Papantonio. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Papantonio, and you've been listening to a free sample of Ring of Fire Radio. If you'd like to listen to the full show, subscribe to our weekly podcast at our website at ringoffireradio.com. It's your support that helps keep us on the air.